Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Rent Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybrow. Today we're talking about two books by Robert Swindles, Stone Cold and Hydra. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. And just a little warning, Stone Cold is on the grittier side. There's a serial killer character. It's a bit, yeah, a bit more violent. Nothing too explicit, but not as fun as some of our topics, but Hydra's pretty fun, so you can skip to the end if you just want that one. All right, enjoy. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning, Ren. And it is the morning.
It's the morning for once. We were recording in the morning. Will this make a difference to our output? Let's see. today, we're going back to Robert Swindles, who we last talked about in 2019.
Years, they go past, they go past.
They do.
I grow old, I grow old, I shall wear my trousers rolled.
With an episode back then, when we were young and dewy-eyed on Room 13 and Nightmare Stairs. And we're back for another double-header today. With Hydra from 1991 and Stone Cold from 1993. Two quite different examples of children's horror. Robert Swindles is a land of contrasts. Shall we start with front covers?
Oh, yeah, actually. That's a great call, because... They have a few. So let's start with Stone Cold. So my cover just looks like it's been taken from a computer screen at the back of a CSI episode.
Okay.
I don't know. It's just a sort of a silhouette. Is yours a sort of gauzy silhouette?
No.
With like light coming in. Is this a possibly sinister shadow?
Okay, no. Mine is I'll explain what mine is, because it's quite striking. Okay. Oh. So this is an illustration by Peter Menem. We've got two blonde-haired young people in like sleeping bags, sleeping on a city street in the foreground. Kind of one turned towards the reader and the other one's turned away. And then looming above them is this man's disembodied face with a really quite strange expression. He's kind of slightly cross-eyed and kind of flaring his nostrils and baring his teeth.
Now you said flaring his nostrils, I'm just imagining Rimmer from Rick.
No, it's a bit Rimmer, yeah.
Okay.
So the impression is a bit Rimmer, but also kind of predatory, but also puzzled.
Puzzled?
I'm gonna put this as the cover image for the episode, I think, so people can see it.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine.
Yeah,
I think I've seen this one before, but I can't remember really. When you say disembodied, like, so it's not like a head on a stick. Presumably, is it floating in the sky?
It's floating sort of above the ground in the street. It's kind of filling the whole alleyway.
Oh my gosh. Well, that is scary, to be fair.
It is, yeah.
I mean, the subtitle, there's a subheading on my cover that says Fear Stalks the Streets.
Mm.
And it does sound like your cover captures that.
Yeah, it doesn't need to say that on mine because it's just... you can see.
Yeah.
It also has a gold embossed Carnegie medal on the cover.
Oh, see, this one just says in small font, winner of the Carnegie medal, which isn't nearly as good.
Yeah. So yeah, I was quite pleased with this cover. I think this is a vintage early 90s one. My Hydra is a re-release that's incredibly like the year 2000, I think.
How so?
Well, it has a kind of blurry kind of horseshoe crab xenomorph kind of image. I think it's the fonts, I think, that are really making it.
I think I've got the same one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that there've actually been quite a lot of different covers for Hydra. Mm. Looking it up, I think some of the kind of non-English, some of the translated ones actually have a rather better Hydra than. Then not that it's called a Hydra. It's a bit weird actually because there's no mention of a Hydra in the book at all. I don't think.
No, only in the
end. And what do you get the creature? Not really how I'd imagine a Hydra to look, let's be honest.
No. Only has one head.
yeah, surely for one thing. The whole point of the Hydra, right? Is that it has multiple heads. So why on earth Swindle's called this Hydra? I really don't know.
Yeah. So there's a... one of the mention, if you have the same coffee, this one made me laugh on the back with the where it has the like the blurbs on one of the blurbs for Hydra is explosive denouement.
Yes. I'm sure lots of kids are gonna see that at the back and be like, oh yes.
Oh, an explosive denouement, you say.
I like also, I mean, you know, not quite the Carnegie medal winner, runner up for the Sheffield Children's Book Award.
Yeah. Well, you know, you gotta start somewhere.
Yeah. But so which book do you want to start with?
I think we start with Stone Cold and then we can have a bit of a lighter ending with Hydra.
Yeah, so as you said, Hydra's the earlier book, but maybe he was warming up to the horrors of Stone Cold. Although, can't remember when he'd done... No, yeah, so looking at the also available, he had done... we did... was it Room 13 we did?
Yeah.
And Nightmare Stairs?
Nightmare Stairs, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so they're early ones. And they are very much like, you know, little Hammer horror stories for children. He'd also done Jacqueline Hyde, which is obviously a reworking of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but with...
Is that what the TV series was based on?
Well, I think it must be, right?
Oh my goodness, yeah, okay.
I don't know if that's a future one to do, that TV series, because the Jacqueline Hyde costume was quite something.
It was quite something, yeah. This is a real, like, deep cut, like...
That's a proper deep cut, yeah.
Children's... British children's TV from the 90s, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, okay. She was really hulking, wasn't she?
She was. Yeah, it was quite like the Honey Monster.
Yeah! It was probably although the Honey Monster was designed by Jim Henson's Creature Factory. Because it seriously, yeah, I've got this amazing book and the Honey Monster's in it, so who knew? I suspect that the company he produced, Jacqueline Hyde, didn't have that kind of money.
Probably not.
But anyway, you know, Swindles would then go on to do Stone Cold and Brother in the Land. And I say that Stone Cold is harrowing. I kind of didn't want to make you read Brother in the Land because I thought you might find it too much.
I think maybe, yeah, it can have its own episode at some point.
Yeah, which is his... we could do an episode on two kind of nuclear wasteland, nuclear holocaust for the kids. Stone Cold, as you say, it's a pretty grim read, and I remember reading this, and I can't remember if it was something that we read in school, and I feel like it might have been. Like, it seems, you know, it had won the Carnegie. Can you remember what year it won the Carnegie?
94.
Okay. So,
Or 93.
I think I might have done it either at the end of primary or the beginning of secondary. You know, it might have been a year seven book. But, yeah, it had a real impact on me. I found it really gripping. I remember really liking it, but I found it really disturbing. And I honestly think it probably shaped me. Like, I do suspect that my tendency to chat to a lot of homeless folks might come from having read this book. I think it... Yeah, it definitely made me think about the experience of homelessness and what it would be like to be homeless, and especially young and homeless, in a way I don't think I'd had before. Which stayed with me. So, you know, obviously I don't think I like trash. I don't think all children's horror needs to necessarily be edifying or shaping kids into thoughtful socialists of the future. But I do think it's pretty worthy in the best possible sense.
Yeah, it does. You can tell from the Goodreads reviews that it has been taught in schools a lot. There's lots of kids griping about their English teachers. So,
I'm glad to see kids are using Goodreads. At least. Get it off TikTok and onto Goodreads.
But yeah, you can see why it would be a good way to get kids to think about homelessness. This I was coming to this for the first time reading it for the podcast. I feel like it was in the school library, but I never picked it up.
I mean, you know, you are like you 2.5 years younger than me, I think. Yeah. Something like that. And I think by the time, you know, you got to in the school library, it was probably quite dog-eared, right? You know, those 2.5 years in that time, you know, the copy had probably fallen apart.
I think I remember seeing, it was either Stone Cold or Brother in the Land looking quite dog-eared and early 90s in the, like, school library rotary stand and being like, nah, that's... No, I'm not. Don't know.
It's like, oh no, instead there's this new shiny Artemis Fowl or something.
Well, they were all the Paul Jennings. Ones with their
exciting double covers.
Exciting double covers, yeah.
Well, I can see how that would have got you.
Yeah. But yeah, so I think possibly venturing into a new horror genre for us. And it's like political horror. Social horror.
Social realist horror.
Yeah.
Kitchen sink horror. Yeah.
Yeah. Because before you even get to the overt horror of the serial killer, there is a serial killer in this book, there's the horror of Thatcherism, basically, which is not mentioned by name, but otherwise quite explicitly set up. The catalyst. So our protagonist is a 16-year-old Link, and it's a nickname who from Bradford, and the catalyst for his homelessness is an abusive stepfather. But the reasons why his situation becomes so bad are like this kind of spiraling combination of sort of lack of apprenticeships or job opportunities and predatory private landlords and kind of cruelty and indifference of what's meant to be the social security system and like the messages of the right-wing media and kind of, yeah, all of that is quite explicitly shown to cause Link's to end up sleeping rough in London. So we kind of have this dual structure for the book. It's very short. It's only 132 pages, and we get the structure of alternating chapters between Link and our antagonist Shelter, nickname is what he calls himself, who is an ex-army drill sergeant who has been discharged on medical grounds, which we kind of quickly pick up from his narrative is code for being a dangerous sadist. And he's keeping a log called Daily Routine Orders that are numbered of his plan to murder homeless children.
and we know he's evil from the font. Because Link has a nice humane serif font in a little curls, so we know he's nice. Whereas Shelter has a sans serif font and looks really regimented and orderly, and we're like, oh, look at this inhumane robot monster. So, you know, I could tell just from that font choice.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
But it's quite useful having the two different fonts, so you don't get them mixed up.
Yeah. He's got this very very creepy voice that he writes in.
It's really hard to play. It's quite insinuating.
I was gonna. I think probably worth reading a bit of it. Okay, Daily Routine Orders 2. I'm getting used to my new name, breaking it in like a pair of new boots. Good morning, Shelter, I say to the bathroom mirror, smiling. Good morning, Shelter. You're a handsome devil, but you're idle, lad. You need a shave. I've been writing it, too, on the backs of old envelopes. Shelter, Shelter, Shelter. It's starting to look like an authentic signature already. I realise, of course, that all this has precious little to do with recruiting. And perhaps you think I'm stalling, putting it off. Not so. I'm merely indulging myself. After all, there's plenty of time. The street people aren't going to go away, and anticipation is the best part of a treat, as my old granny never used to say. So it's a case of wait for it, you horrible little man.
There's this weird kind of faux friendliness to it, like this barely contained rage. And it is good at building this horrid sense of complicity, like he's talking to you. I mean, they both are, you know, Link and Shelter. I think it's really effective, actually. Mm. It's quite cinematic, this cross-cutting between the two, these dual narratives.
Mm.
It's good for creating, like, dramatic irony and suspense, or, you know, so obviously, we really care about Link and want Link to be okay. And we know from Shelter's account that he's spotted Link and that Link's one of his new targets. And he's sort of stalking him.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of cutting to Link doing things and going about his day. And then back to Shelter talking about Link. Mm-hmm. And obviously from his perspective, Link is just this victim, you know, just a target. Whereas, obviously, we know Link as a human being. And I think it's really effective, actually. Like, it makes the dehumanization hit harder.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a really clever device. Like, it's much more effective than if it was just narrated from one of those two perspectives.
Yes. Yeah, agreed. So Shelter's plan is to kind of act the part of the sort of non-threatening do-gooder, dress in cords and sweaters, adopt a cat, and offer street kids a bed to sleep on at his place, and kill them and stash their bodies in the ventilated space under his floorboards. There's some sort of interesting stuff about his how Shelter presents himself. He's this kind of act of how he's kind of the sort of specific persona he's going for. It seems to kind of be like, well, I've kind of written like homosexual in brackets, unthreatening.
That's really, yeah.
Like, not to jump too far ahead, but when Link kind of eventually sort of ends up in Shelter's flat, he's kind of, he sort of is like, he says that this is the kind of man that his auntie would describe as a Mary Ellen. which is not a mainstream piece of slang as far as I can find, but I think sort of fussy, tidy, but I think there's definitely like, I think homosexual brackets unthreatening is it.
Yeah, and maybe a bit tweety. And
there is insinuation of the other kind of homosexual, but yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I guess I was also reading it as how maybe the right wing imagines a kind of ineffectual left-wing tweedy academic.
Yeah.
Like why I think a lot of people on the right are so dismissive or found it so easy to be contemptuous of Corbyn.
Yes.
Like, oh, he's probably got an allotment, you know, that.
Yeah. That did also occur to me, yeah. That there's a... the Corbyn comparison.
Yeah, or like the sort of idea of, oh, it's not a man, you know, like a sort of a soft liberal do-gooder, I guess, is the kind of...
Yeah.
It's interesting having this character adopt that persona, because it's obviously a kind of figure he'd be quite contemptuous of, mm-hmm. but he's having to sort of adopt it to fulfil his kind of really predatory...
Yeah, but he also does have his own prissiness.
That's true.
He doesn't swear. Like, one of his repeated phrases is "By golly, I will," which is really sinister. Like, and sort of really, I think that sort of touch of like, oh, he's, you know, this murderer who is squeamish about swearing is quite. Yeah.
I guess it's a bit like Annie Wilkes in Misery.
Oh, I don't know.
Because I think part of what makes her character sort of disturbing is that, you know, she's willing to use extreme violence and be homicidal, but at the same time, yeah, she doesn't like swearing and uses a lot of these sort of Ned Flanders-like euphemisms.
Yeah. So Link... Link is a sympathetic character. Crucially, he doesn't drink or take drugs, which is kind of Swindle's sort of keeping it simple in a kind of book aimed at teenagers. people are more likely to blame addicts for
their
situation.
I mean, I think this must have come out around the same time. I'm just going to have to look it up when Melvin... is it Melvin Burgess who did Junk?
Junk, yeah.
Yeah.
I learned so much from that book.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what year Junk was. That's 96, interestingly.
Yeah.
So that's set in Bristol with two homeless... Well, they're squatters, I think. So, yeah, homeless squatters, I guess. Teenagers in Bristol who become heroin addicts.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I guess that's more complex in terms of character identification. Like, that, you know, both characters are definitely sympathetic, but the male character starts with becoming abusive himself, or like he's had a really abusive father and ends up kind of falling into those patterns and sort of hating himself because he recognises that he's becoming like his father as he sort of descends more into the heroin addiction. And
I think Gemma is the lead, is the protagonist in Junk. But she's that has such an interesting book. Yeah, but she is very... I remember her being very sympathetic.
I think Gemma really anchors it. But yeah, they would be interesting comparison pieces. Actually, it's a little bit too long. I have reread it, but in my 20s, so it's been a little bit too long since I read it to remember it quite clearly enough. But yeah, they would be interesting books to pair together.
Yeah, you can... And it is sort of mentioned in the text, so Link meets another teenager called Ginger, who kind of teaches him how to live on the street, and Ginger writes a sign for them to hold that's homeless, non-alcoholic, and he's like, yeah, they won't give you money if they think you're... if they think you're alcoholic, kind of thing. It's not completely ignored, but I think Link is quite sort of straightforwardly sympathetic. There aren't really anything to complicate that.
that is very true. And I mean, I guess it would end up maybe being overly complex. Obviously, one of the complicated things about someone being alcoholic and on the streets is that, realistically, if you just go cold turkey, you're going to go into alcohol withdrawal, which is seriously risky.
Yeah.
Even compared to withdrawing from heroin. So, alcohol withdrawal is dangerous. You can die if you just go completely cold turkey, if you've been a heavy drinker. It's really because, I've seen the argument, you give money to a homeless person, they're buying alcohol, you could be endangering their life, but you can also be endangering their life not giving them money for alcohol, literally. To be honest, I think, I don't know, I think I could see why he does it, because it's so often what people use to just not engage with people who are homeless or give money or talk to people homeless. They're like, oh, well, they're addicts. Mm-hmm. Let's be honest, a lot of addicts, I don't know in terms of percentages, but it does tend to go hand in hand with trauma, right?
Absolutely.
It would make sense, I think, if you've, say, been abused or otherwise exploited and mistreated why you might turn to substances, to be honest.
Yeah. And yeah, not to, as well as the trauma of being on the streets.
Yeah, and being cold.
and we can talk about that, but we can read about the book, because as researcher, Swindle went out and slept rough in central London himself for a few days, and also, and probably more importantly, talked to homeless people he met there. And I think if we read, it's like, do you want to read, it's like page 56 to 57 in my copy, where he's talking about trying to sleep on the cold pavement.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'll read a bit of that, actually. It's a particularly effective bit, yeah.
Yeah.
If you think sleeping rough's just a matter of finding a dry spot where the fuzz won't move you on and getting your head down, you're wrong. Not your fault, of course. If you've never tried it, you've no way of knowing what it's like. So what I thought I'd do was sort of talk you through a typical night. That night in the vaudeville alcove won't do, because there are two of us, and it's worse if you're by yourself. So, you pick your spot. Wherever it is, unless you're in a squat or a derelict house or something, it's going to have a floor of stone, tile, concrete or brick. In other words, it's going to be hard and cold. Might be a bit cramped too, shop doorways often are. And remember, if it's winter, you're going to be half frozen before you even start. Anyway, you've got your place, and if you're lucky enough to have a sleeping bag, you unroll it and get in. Settled for the night? Well, maybe. Maybe not. Remember my first night? The Scouser. Of course you do. He kicked me out of my bedroom and pinched my watch. Well, that sort of thing can happen any night. And there are worse things. You could be peed on by a drunk or a dog. It happens all the time. One man's bedroom is another man's lavatory. You might be spotted by a gang of lager-louts on the lookout for someone to maim. That happens all the time too, and if they get carried away, you can end up dead. There are the guys who like young boys and think because you're a dosser, you'll do anything for dosh. And there's the psycho who'll knife you for your pack. So, you lie listening. You bet you do. Footsteps. Voices. Breathing even. Doesn't help you sleep. Then there's your bruises. What bruises? Try lying on a stone floor for half an hour. Just half an hour. You can choose any position you fancy, and you can change position as often as you like. You won't find it comfy, I can tell you. You won't sleep unless you're dead drunk or zonked on downers. And if you are, and do, you're going to wake up with bruises on hips, shoulders, elbows, ankles and knees. Especially if you're a bit thin from not eating properly. And if you do that 6 hours a night for 6 nights, you'll feel like you fell out of a train. Try sleeping on concrete then. And don't forget the cold. If you've ever tried dropping off to sleep with cold feet, even in bed, you'll know it's impossible. You've got to warm up those feet or lie awake. And in January, in a doorway, in wet trainers, it can be quite a struggle. And if you manage it, chances are you'll need to get up for a pee. And then it starts all over again. And those are only some of the hassles. I haven't mentioned stomach cramps from hunger, headaches from the flu, toothache, fleas and lice. I haven't talked about homesickness, depression or despair. And I haven't gone into how it feels to want a girlfriend when your circumstances make it virtually impossible for you to get one. How it feels to know you're a social outcast, in fact, a non-person to whom every ordinary, everyday experience is closed.
Thank you, Adam.
Yeah, I think it also captures like how much of a dramatic monologue a lot of Link's chapters are.
Yeah,
I don't know if this was ever adapted to stage, but you can imagine it as two kind of competing monologues on a stage.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, I feel like you can feel in that extract that Robert Swindles did go and try and sleep on some pavement. Obviously, there's just like going and trying out being homeless is not like,
like no, it's only going to give you a partial, partial.
For writing, you know, quite useful, I think. As well as all of those troubles, yeah, Link is having to contend with Shelter, whose political project is to lure vulnerable homeless kids to his home, kill them, and stash them under his floorboards as his army, which he ends up calling the Camden Horizontals, which is particularly nasty. He's sort of cutting their hair post-mortem and sort of dressing them up in surplus army gear. Shelter's kind of has, yeah, as you said, he sort of briefly encounters Link and Ginger early on when they ask him for money, and then they laugh at him. So he calls them Laughing Boy 1 and 2, and he like sets his sights on them, and he gets an opportunity. So Ginger goes off to do an errand by himself, and Shelter tricks him into following him home, like telling him that Link is hurt and that Shelter has him at home. So and when he gets there, Shelter kills him. So Link's kind of obviously upset that Ginger's disappeared and doesn't know what's happened to him, but then he meets a girl in a cafe, a fellow Dosser, as he calls him, but one he's immediately attracted to, called Gale, and they kind of start hanging around together, and Link's besotted enough that he doesn't sort of key into the clues that there's something a bit off about her. They kind of they sort of start putting pieces together about Shelter. Sort of there's kind of someone seen one, you know, there's a few missing homeless kids now, and someone's seen one of them with a man in his 40s, kind of, in so they're kind of starting to sort of put it together. They kind of go to the police, and then the police go to Shelter's door, and he does his do good a big softy act and totally fools them. But
there's a parent looking around, a dad looking for his daughter, who we know that Shelter's killed.
Yeah.
As well, which is pretty bleak.
Yeah, and that's another sort of moment of contrast, because of we've had Shelter's sort of dehumanizing narrative about this girl, and then we get, you know, the father looking for his beloved daughter, kind of thing. So yeah, that really hits home. Link ends up sort of hanging around outside Shelter's flat and decides that you know, he's got it wrong and that Shelter's harmless, and kind of Shelter invites him in. And then Link sees his watch on the side cabinet that was stolen, as mentioned in the extract Adam read, stolen by the Skelser the first night he was in London. And then the Skelser was killed by Shelter. So, Shelter drops the act, and it's just quite horrible. let me read a bit of it. So he's there. Shelter's sort of has picked him up, and he says, "The strength of the insane. I'd come across the phrase, and now I found out what it meant. I'm not a small guy, and he was a lot older, but I couldn't break free. I bucked and writhed and lashed out with my feet, but he'd wrapped his arms around me, and his grip was like bands of steel. My feet left the floor, and he carried me across the room like he'd carried the cat, except he didn't croon or nuzzle, and when we reached the hole in the floor, he threw me down and fell on me like a wrestler. I was pinned, lying on my stomach with my head overhanging the hole. A draft rose from the hole, carrying a cloying, sweetish smell. After a few seconds, my eyes adjusted to the dimness, and I saw them. There were seven, laid out in a row like sardines. He'd done something to their heads. They were all like his. You couldn't tell if they were girls or boys, but I recognized Ginger by his clothes. His face was, well, I wouldn't have known him from that. I gagged, twisting my head to one side. Let me up, I screamed. I'm going to puke. Yeah. And he's saved by Gail coming in, but yeah, she's followed by a camera crew, and it turns out that her name's actually Louise, and she's a journalist who's been researching homelessness for the last few months and sort of stumbled into this story of the serial killer murdering homeless youth, and now it's her scoop. So it really sort of ends on this kind of Link feeling deeply betrayed, and yeah, it's a really bleak ending.
It's also really interesting, right? Like, is it a mea culpa from Swindles? Like, it's quite interesting that I don't know if there's a kind of a certain discomfort with his own role as a writer, and the fact that he's gone out and talked to or befriended homeless people and has done it so he could write this book, or whether he's kind of doing it to kind of differentiate himself from a more maybe cynical, opportunistic journalistic practice. Like, as a fiction writer, that he's doing something kind of different to what someone working for a newspaper or a TV company might do. I don't know, I just found that it's quite interesting. I don't know if it's a completely unexpected ending. As he said, we get the sense that something's up with Gail. She keeps supposedly phoning her sister, and it's mentioned enough times that we know that it can't be that she's doing talking to someone. And I don't know if the betrayal is partly like a class betrayal, right? So her boyfriend is really obviously written as kind of comfortably upper middle class,
and he's like, you know, Link's really upset, and he's like, oh god, she saved your life, like, come on. So yeah, he doesn't understand, you know, and Gail sort of tells Link, like, her story is that she had an abusive stepfather as well. So them being in the same situation.
Yeah, but it's a really interesting ambivalent ending. Can I just sort of read the end of it?
Yeah, please.
Gail, who's actually called Louise, you know, gives him some money. And, you know, she is, you know, a human being. Like, she's not, you know, depicted as some kind of cynical, cynical jerk. Like you can hear that she clearly does care about what she's doing, and she clearly has come to care for Link and befriended him. So she gives him this wad of banknotes and says she's really sorry. Link says, yeah, I know. I ought to have chucked the money in her face. A telly hero would have. But then a telly hero doesn't have to live on the streets. Anyway, that's the sort of happy ending it was. Yeah, but like, justice was done, right? Was it though? Shelter, that's what he calls himself, they found a sort of logbook. Shelter gets life, which means he gets a roof, a bed, and 3 square meals a day. I don't. What I hope is this. I hope when Louise and Gavin do their story, it'll have some truth in it, and that a lot of people will read it. People can only start to make things better if they know what's going on. There has to be an end to this someday. I just hope it happens while I'm still around. In the meantime, though, I'm not sure what I'll do. Can't stay around Camden, that's for sure. Too many ghosts. I'll be forever seeing Gail across the street, or Ginger. I might try the Embankment or Covent Garden. There's a lot like me round Covent Garden. Or, of course, I could leave London altogether. It's a free country, right? That final line, it's a free country, right? Uh-huh, it seems like a right fine jab at that.
Absolutely. Yeah, and just like, the character of Link is just someone who's just been shut out of every opportunity. And, even if there might, you can imagine, oh, but there must be some sort of charity that would help him. Well, if there is, he doesn't know about it and no one's told him. So, you know, as far as he knows, there is no one to help him and nowhere to turn.
But I respect Swindles not just giving it a really cozy ending. And actually, similar, without giving away too much, similar in some ways to Brother in the Land. And actually, Brother in the Land, looking this up, I was wrong. It's actually quite an early one, Brother in the Land, from 1984. Yeah. So he had already done kind of more, I want to say, grounded horror. Or like the horror where, the horror comes from things that are not kind of too fantastical, I guess. I guess we could say that he kind of operates in two modes of more fun escapist horror and then more kind of gritty. You know, Stone Cold is not fun. I mean, did you I don't say enjoy, because it's not exactly enjoyable. Appreciate it?
It's well structured and like snappy and compelling. It really does. It really does its job.
I think it does. It does what it sets out to do.
Yeah.
And it's short, which is always an advantage as a teacher, because.
Would you teach this to yourself?
I would. I mean, there's not so much language analysis you can do. But in terms of structure, and actually, you know, talking about structure is something that kids find very hard to do, actually. And I think where some kids fall down with their GCSEs is, you know, they've got good at the language analysis, but they don't think about structure and form at all. So actually, it could be useful in that regards. And I say, you know, it's a good little length. Like, I've been, you know, the last 2 years, I've been reading my way through Middlemarch.
Have you? I'm also reading Middlemarch.
Oh, and it's so well written, right? I mean, not that it's so obviously a genius, and yet it's so slow. It's like I simultaneously feel like, okay, this is clearly incredible. Like, you know, almost every sentence you're like, oh, George Eliot, you are much smarter than me. And yet I'm like, how have you taken Village Gossip and made it into a whole novel? And it's this long, how?
I've been reading it since January and I think I'm about 60% through.
And it's like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's such a weird thing to eat because on some level, it's obviously brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, like sometimes quite staggeringly good. It kind of makes Dickens, and obviously, you know, it did used to be that kids would read Dickens, and it really makes Dickens seem a bit juvenile, I think, by comparison.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, these are real human beings, you know, this is amazing character writing.
Absolutely.
you've got to get into a different headspace, a different time space, I think.
Yeah. It's like, right, you're just sitting down for several hours to read this, and by the time you're done, like, I don't know, maybe some people will have had some conversations, like, about who's leaving who money in a will, or local politics, so, Dorothea may have had some feelings.
And it's kind of like a soap, but a soap with very kind of low, quiet drama and written in the most sophisticated way possible.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, I mentioned Middlemarch because, amusingly, Michael Gove said that it should be on the syllabus and taught to kids.
Jesus Christ, yeah.
Yeah, back when he was education minister. And it was like, yeah, I just try to imagine, like, teaching Middlemarch to, like, a bunch of, you know, 16-year-olds or 14-year-olds. No, yeah. It's not going to happen.
Yeah. As I've been reading it, I've been like, I don't know if I would have... Yeah. I would have struggled to read this at degree level just due to the length and the denseness,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think you've got to challenge kids. I don't think, you know, I like the idea of meeting kids where they're at, but, you know, that doesn't mean that there should also be some challenge, you know, or some level of sort of aspiration in what you're reading. Yeah. But you've got to be realistic. Come on, not Middlemarch. But actually, I did read Hydra, or didn't get through all of it, but did read a lot of Hydra with my year sevens last year because we finished what we were doing, basically. Mm. So we got through a whole scheme of work, and there's still like 4 weeks left at the end of the term. And so I asked the head of department, what should I do now? And he said, oh, well, just choose whatever book, you know, choose any of the books that we've got a whole lot of copies of, basically, that you want, you know, do that. So I could have made my own little scheme of work based around Hydra. And generally speaking, I'd say the kids were pretty receptive to it. What they didn't like, interestingly, was the romance element. And as much as this is a sort of alien thriller, it is also something of a romance, surprisingly.
Yeah.
Like, fairly considerably, I would say. More than you would expect. So you've got these characters of Ben and Midge, who are friends, and, you know, they're only kids. Like, I can't remember how old they are. Like, I don't know, 12?
They're talking about going to secondary school next year, so they've got a bit... So they're 11?
Yeah, or it might be a secondary... I think this is set somewhere where there's a middle school, maybe.
Oh, right, yeah.
But anyway, you know, they're not that old. It's not like...
Yeah.
That, like, I find it... I mean, I've sort of mentioned this before, but one of the sort of fascinating things I find, and I'm sure this was ever the case, it's just maybe got a bit more pronounced, is that, like, some of the 11-year-olds, I thought, will make the most awful innuendo and things, or laugh at, you know, the merest suggestion of... Basically, you know, words they've heard from TikTok, mostly, I think.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure some of them have been exposed to more than that online, but some of them haven't, you know. Some of them, it's just the language. But, like, there's a fair amount of inappropriately sexualized banter that, you know, you have to kind of rein in and do safeguarding reports about. And yet, at the same time, as soon as there's any kind of romantic, emotional intimacy, either on screen or on the page, they freak out.
Okay. Yeah.
So as soon as there was hand holding in this book, my word! You know, arms thrown in. Wah! We can't be. This is inappropriate. We can't be doing this. Wah! Wah! It's like, what on earth? It's so strange.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very, okay. Very odd. So, you know, it's very mild romance, but too rich for the blood of the 11-year-olds I was teaching. So, yes, unexpectedly, that caused a bit of an issue. Much to my bemusement.
Bizarre. Yeah, okay.
Yep. But yeah, I mean, we talked about Stone Cold as having a dual narrative. This is incredibly structurally ambitious. Like, it jumps between a lot of characters.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, and the first character perspective is the aliens.
Yeah, I mean, it's third person. So it's not first person. It's sort of what I've called before sympathetically aligned. And I think there is a technical term for it, but I can't remember what it is. But it's like third person, but the narrative voice is very closely linked. It's a bit like an over-the-shoulder shot.
Yeah. Close third, I think it's called.
Okay, close third, cool. So yeah, as you say, it starts with kind of the perspective of the alien, which is cool.
Yeah. Do we want to read that, maybe?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. One. It was sick and hungry and a long, long way from home. It had little brain, but it sensed that the tank was a hostile environment and it cruised around the wall, revolving slowly about its axis, bumping the frost-rimmed metal till it found the door. As the floater's soft bulk bumped against it, the door moved. The floater felt the motion and bumped again. Minute ice flakes, dislodged from the hinges, drifted down, melting in the first waft of warm air as the door swung outward. The temperature inside the tank rose a half degree. The floaters, half poisoned by the chemical cocktail mist in which they fed, didn't notice. As the creature entered the airlock, the woman jabbed the close button and the door swung slowly, clunking into its housing. Smiling behind her face mask, she opened the outer door and stood aside. The floater moved out into the barn. Eyeless, it felt the faint pool of starlight and followed, passing through the great open doorway and drifting away in the dark.
Yeah.
And that's a whole chapter.
Yeah.
So one thing I like about this book, because this is a longer book than Stone Cold. And yeah, the chapters are very short.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it feels quite cinematic, I think. We jump between these different scenes and perspectives. And yeah, I think it's a flawed book, but that's one thing I really like about it is the way that it kind of jumps back and forth. We get these different scenes, different perspectives. And I think it does keep what is actually a fairly slow story more dynamic.
Yeah.
And if we couldn't picture the floater, we get nice little drawings at the start of each chapter.
So this is my favourite thing about the book. Oh, well, one of my favourite things. It's illustrations by Mark Robertson. There's a illustration above each chapter heading of these aliens that are initially described as floaters. And they start off jellyfish-like, and kind of over the first sort of 30-something chapters, they are still these jellyfish, but just sort of slowly shedding their tentacles. which is really neat. And then between chapter 31 and 36, it sort of transforms into its adult form. And I think My text.
It's probably okay. Yeah, go on. So I was going to sing text of the week. Do you know? I don't know if this is a bit gauche, but gauche. I don't know if it's a bit gauche, but I don't know if do you know the song Homeless from Paul Simon's Graceland album?
No, not to memory, no.
Okay, because it came into my head, and then I was like, huh, you can go, texture of the wheat, texture of the week. But I guess you don't know the backing vocals.
I don't know. It's been quite some time since I've listened to.
Okay, well, when I go texture, if you do a quieter texture like that, kind of call and response thing. Okay,
okay, so, all right.
Texture. So so quicker. right off the back of it, you do what you did. Okay.
Okay.
Texture of the week. Yeah, nice.
Okay.
Okay, so what's your texture of the week?
My texture of the week is chapter 34 in its
entirety. Oh, I think that's probably the... Yeah, the same, it's the same. Obviously it's the same, it's the best texture. I was like, can I do a whole chapter for a texture? But you have to. Good. do you want to read it?
Yeah, okay. Chapter 34. It was night when the real change came. The terrestrial slept. There was no witness. During the course of the evening, the largest floater had risen till it hung just beneath the domed roof of the tank. Spikes like a crown of thorns circled its mantle. It had ceased to rotate. Instead, it began a sort of bobbing motion, ascending a little, sinking back, ascending again, like a boat on an oily swell. As it did so, a shallow depression appeared at the centre of its mantle. Gradually, this deepened, so that the creature appeared to be falling into itself. As the hollow deepened, a bump appeared on the floater's underside, growing as the depression on top became more pronounced. As the process continued, the spiked rim of the floater's mantle was drawn in towards the centre, and the creature's diameter slowly shrank as it poured its substance into the bump which hung from its underside, elongating like a great glob of wax falling in slow motion from a melting candle. For a while, the creature resembled a monstrous floating flower, its ring of spiky petals closing. But as the process of change became complete, an observer would have realized that the flower's head had become a great mouth ringed with spiky teeth, that the floater, by turning itself inside out, had become another creature.
Gross!
Brilliant.
it's really cool. As it poured its substance into the bump, which hung from the outside, elongating like a great glob of wax. That's horrid.
Yeah, it really is, yeah. it's an ambitious book, isn't it?
Yeah, for a book which is mostly a lark, it's not a book of, great thematic depth compared to Stone Cold. It is really ambitious.
Also does kill a dog.
It does, actually, yeah. Mm. I do wish that the creature, maybe this is a bit bloodthirsty, but I do kind of wish it had killed a few more. I feel like it doesn't quite, because it builds up so much to this transformation.
Yeah.
You're like, oh my god, it's on now. Right, it's ready. It's ready for a killing spree. It's gonna take over the world. And it doesn't get very far, to be honest. They're not very a bit like the obviously the Martians in War of the Worlds get a bit further. But like the Martians in War of the Worlds, they're not very adapted. They should have thought it through. They're not very adapted to this climate. They basically can't cope with the climate conditions. So once they're outside their chamber...
They dissolve.
They dissolve, yeah. They melt, and that's that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I was kind of half expecting them to get into the library. I don't know.
Ooh, like, that would have been fun.
Because Ben's mum works at the library and it keeps being mentioned. And
Yeah, and those parents, they're so, as ever in children's horror, they doubt the kids. That would have shown them what for.
um, And we do get a full page illustration of the
Well, yes, we do, and I'll tell you what kids enjoy. Well, okay, this is interesting, to be fair. So we get this full page illustration of the copies of this book, clearly dated back from the 90s from when it came out, so they've probably been left in the cupboard for the best part of a decade, if not more. Yeah, we all got to that illustration. I'm, you know, quite excited about getting to the full page illustration. And this creature, so it's not really a hydra. It's
no.
I don't really know how you describe it. It's like a horrid newt with wings, I guess.
Mm. Big teeth.
Big, the sort of maw is quite bestial. Mm. It's like sort of a dog crossed with an eel, maybe. Like, it's got a little beard.
It's quite dribbly as well.
It's quite dribbly in the way that a dog could be, but it's also got kind of moray eel-like fangs.
Yeah.
So spit coming down from its fangs. It's got these great, great kind of horned wings, or wings with kind of spikes coming out of them. Mm. And then kind of a dorsal fin, possibly. So there's a kind of, is it a fin coming out of the side? Well, that's whatever it is.
Oh.
Yes,
okay.
Whatever it is, that's certainly not what a lot of young people had thought it was. And they had extended this extrusion obscenely on many, many, many of the copies of the books. So anatomy of different shapes and sizes. but what was funny, so this was, you know, this was to the great, great delight and amusement, you know, however shocked and horrified they were by hand-holding, they were not shocked and horrified by this. Quite the opposite. The kids who had copies with the graffiti, very keen, they were very keen to share around their copies and show everyone. But what really amused me, and I pointed this out to the kids, is that this was their parents' generation. And a lot of kids at my school, right, went to literally the same school as their parents. I'm like, these could have been drawn by your literal parents. I said, go home to your dad tonight, you know, ask them if they remember studying Hydra at school. Because if so... So I did find that quite funny. An educational bridge connecting parent
the
and
generations.
Child.
Yeah, wow.
Exactly.
That's what we call the teacher's insight.
Folks. Yeah. So that was a noisy lesson. But yeah, it is a really good creature. I just wish it got to do a bit more. Although I do like the fact that the drawing at the end does show it melted.
Oh yeah.
It's just a puddle with like two kind of eyes, I think, and its teeth.
Yeah, it's good.
And it's funny because it ends, I say, it's surprisingly soppy, some of this book, between Ben and Midge, who are the two child investigators. And I like the fact that there's this recurring reference or motif of Midge's Mona Lisa smile, which Ben keeps fixating on. So it ends with Ben looking at her and saw that smile, that Mona Lisa smile. And then we get the jawbone of the creature underneath it. I'm like, well, I don't need that association. I'm assuming that Midge's Mona Lisa smile doesn't look like that.
Yeah. As she unhinges her jaw.
Yeah. The villains are quite sinister as well. You know, they're not.
The villains
are.
We do have another adult who is quite happy to kill children in this book.
Yeah. That's true. She's pretty nasty. So, what's her name? Wanda. Wanda Free, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah,
which is a pun of sorts, I think.
Yeah, I was wondering if we were going to find out that was a pseudonym, because she was sort of because she was on the run from having done NASA crimes.
Yeah.
But no, apparently that is her name.
Okay. Yeah, very odd. But yeah, she's sort of, you know, maniacal scientist type who becomes increasingly obsessed with, I don't know, well, fame and fortune to a degree, but I think also she just loves the idea of having control over the aliens and letting the aliens out into the world and being like, aha, that was me, I did that. I let the alien plague upon humanity. Ha ha, I think, basically.
Yeah, yeah, that does seem to be her deal.
And she's sort of teamed up with a very sort of cynical, greasy journalist type. Mm. Well, sort of rich. I think he did own a newspaper. Exley.
Yeah.
Who is one of those kind of characters, a bit like a character that Eric Idle would play in a children's horror film. So if you think of the Casper movie, kind of like the Eric Idle character in that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, a completely kind of spineless sort of money craving, not necessarily actively evil, but just with like no moral backbone whatsoever, basically.
Yeah. Any other stray Hydra observations?
I'm not sure. There was a bit. Did you mention this when you were there? There's a bit where there's a food choice, which I think Ben strayed.
Yeah, I feel like Tahini gets unfairly maligned in this book, because the people, Exley and Wanda Free, move up onto this farm. And to make the point that they're sort of different from the locals, it says that they read the Daily Telegraph and they cook with tahini. And I just found that an odd combination of cultural stereotypes, to be fair. Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't know. I come from the country, so, you know, this is just you're a Londoner. You know, it's just you and your London tahini in Suffolk. We don't have no tahini in Suffolk. You London types coming down here with your tahini.
Well, I feel like it would more be like reading The Guardian and tahini. I don't know what I stereotypically associate with Daily Telegraph. What do they eat? I don't know. Union Jacks.
Bourbon biscuits with Union Jacks emblazoned on them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. the food. the worst thing to eat.
Right. That's good. We end on a lighter note after.
Yeah,
the gritty realism of Stone Cold.
Yeah, so I mean, we might always go back to Swindles because he was pretty prolific and generally did work within a broad children's horror vein.
Yeah, definitely. and we were saying before we started recording that if we were a YouTube podcast, our clickbaity promo image would be like Stone Cold's this is the book that stopped Adam being a Thatcherite. Making expressions.
Yeah. Looking shocked. Yeah.
If it weren't for this book, Adam would be a Thatcherite.
Yeah. That's the way you get them. As ever, as Thatcher was laissez-faire about economics, we're laissez-faire about growing our listenership. assuming that the invisible hand of the market will do it for us.
All right.
So, review our podcast. Thanks.
Oh, yeah. Apparently some people have, but I can't see them.
What do you mean? Where have you heard on the grapevine? Rumour has it.
You know, I think it's on Spotify that's like, it's like there are reviews, but it's like, oh, you have to listen to this podcast to review it. Simply making it is not enough.
Oh no, we're locked out of our own reviews.
But yeah.
Well, thanks. Cool. Thanks, mysterious people. That's good.
It has about a four-star average, which seems fair.
Fair. You know, we're good, but we're not that good. I take it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, a bit rough around the edges. Yeah.
Oh.
Great.
Yeah.
So, do we have any remaining avenues of self-promotion? Yeah, I think we're still on Instagram. I make collages. Yeah,
you do your collage. You should have. Are you going to combine these two books in a very strange collage?
Yes, I am.
Okay, that's going to be quite cool then. I'm looking forward to that.
Still Scared Podcast on Instagram. You can email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com. And we don't check the emails very often. But when we do, it's nice to have an email from a listener rather than from a spam.
Yeah. Op. Yeah.
So.
I mean, spam bots probably listen to our podcast too, but yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Our intro music's by Becky Yamazaki. Yeah, our outro music's by Joe Kelly. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. I'll put links to their stuff in the show notes. Do you have a sign off for us, Adam?
Read Middlemarch, but don't eat bourbon biscuits, creepy kids.
Yeah. Mm. All right. See you next time, spooky kids.
Bye.